You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Somebody asked me what that was, and that is Iggy Pop, Lust for Life. So Jim Rome uses it. Joining me from, not Rome, but Texas, is Tim Lynch. Timmy, what's going on?
Not much, Mac. Always a pleasure to link up with you and Jeff.
All right. Well, pleasure likewise. And from Southern California, right, is Jeff Kenny. Jeff, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Good to be with you guys, you and Timmy again. I'm heading to San Francisco tomorrow morning, so I want to be able to talk to you.
What are you doing in Northern California? What's going on?
Well, I'm teaching the Marine Reserve officers. Put them through an advisor orientation package because that's what their bailiwick's going to be up there.
Oh, really? Are they going to dedicate the? Is that going to be the primary mission of the reserve? Right, element, the reserve regiment, or is
I don't
it
know.
Just
it's hard to tell at this point. There's a lot of, but they got some experienced field grades up there and also over in Virginia that could definitely take some of the pressure off units that were sent out there now from the active duty force, you know.
Got it. All right.
These are highly talented, very eclectic individuals, you know, so it's a good bunch.
We'll talk. So, how long are you going to be up there? How long are you going to be doing?
Till Sunday.
Till Sunday. Got it. All right.
I'm going to, for the first time in my life, go to the Marine Memorial Hotel or whatever it is.
Yeah, I've never been there.
Me either. I've heard a lot about it.
So. Timmy, you been there?
I've been to San Francisco a few times.
No. Have you been to the Marine Memorial Hotel?
Oh, I've been there too.
Oh.
Yeah, I stayed there. Once. It was a nice place. It was back in the 90s. I was there. It was
big timer.
Super nice. Very reasonable for Marines.
Well, you know who runs it now is retired Marine General Mike Myatt.
Wow.
I did not. Wow.
Very appropriate.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Unless he stepped down, but he has been the CEO of that thing. And he was very instrumental when I was at OneMath before I retired. He was very instrumental in what do we call civil military operations? what do we call those things? I can't remember. But they brought a ton of people from the Bay Area, right, where obviously the earthquake threat is real, down to Camp Pendleton. And there's a name for it. The name escapes me now. But and we talked about, you know, and this is in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, where we watched, right, New Orleans sit there with active duty military bases ringing the region as they sat there and watched, twiddle their thumbs as, you know, the reserves guys, you know, had to bail themselves out and then had to report, which took, you know, days and then kind of get their act together and then get there. And, you know, the nation watched it on TV. So,
you know, that's amazing you bring that up, Mac, because remember General or Colonel Ebert, the CEO of the basic school
when I was there.
Before. Yeah, he was a CEO when I went through as a student.
Yeah, me too.
And he was the
emergency operation manager.
Yeah, exactly right. I saw him on TV. I loved that guy. He would give us talks, you know, about being in the infantry and stuff that were because he was the company commander, Navy Cross winner, and I think Echo 2-5. In 65, 66, you know, and he just was the greatest guy. But I remember seeing him on TV. I remember that.
I stood in formation at his retirement ceremony. And Colonel Kelly took over. Was it Colonel Kelly? I don't know.
Yeah, Kelly. Another Navy Cross guy for me.
No, I thought Kelly was there when we were there as instructors.
He was. He was after Colonel
Kelly. Yeah, he was.
So I stood, you know, and Ebert, he left in the same Corvette that he showed up in as lieutenant. It was awesome. It was awesome. And then during the ceremony, he was wounded badly in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Right.
He had like a 12-7 in the chest.
Right. And I want to say his radio operator or one of the Marines in the platoon, right, his gear was laying there right after they medevaced him, and they thought he was dead because of the nature of the gunshot wound.
Right.
And he had a knife. He had a
bone handle knife, yeah.
Right. I mean, it's this big-ass fucking Marine knife, right? And this guy had kept it all these years, but he thought that Lieutenant Ebert had died. And he shows back up, and he presents it to Colonel Ebert at the ceremony. And holy shit.
He told a story about the guy, kid he wrote up for a Medal of Honor but got the Navy Cross, his machine gunner, Bolio, who he met Bolio in Pendleton bailing him out of jail 2 days in a row. And I don't know if you guys remember that. It was just a great – and if you look up Navy Cross in Vietnam, which I bought that book when I was in the basic school, because there's Terry Ebert and then there's Bolio in there too, you know. It's amazing stuff. Yeah.
Right. No, and, you know, so we have the ceremony and, you know, and then afterwards a little social. And then he gets in his fucking Corvette. It was a convertible, and it had those kind of like those side, and they're not fenders, but those air baffle things that they had in the early 60s. And it was a convertible, and top was down, man. And he took off down with MCV4, whatever the fuck that is. Heads out to
MCV3.
That heads out to the fire station, and you're just looking at it going, how awesome is that? But it was a cool day because those guys, there probably was a dozen members of his platoon from Vietnam that came back to his retirement.
That's so great.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
You know, that Marine Memorial Club, my best friend's dad is kind of like he passed away back in, like about 5 or 6 years ago, but his dad was a Marine in Korea. His name's Mike Maimon, was my friend. But his dad was Ray Maimon, and Ray was a vice president of Bechtel. And they're up there in the Marine Memorial Club drinking, and who shows up but Brute Kulak? And he's telling them, this is in like 75, he says, yeah, we're doing this new fucking thing.
Uh-oh, we lost Jeff. He's got a dicey internet.
Yeah.
He's got a dicey internet connection today. So we'll wait till he yells again. The what else? I was going to tell you one other thing about that. Oh, back to the emergency management piece of it.
Right.
The General Myatt was instrumental in all these people, you know, coming to Pendleton. And state people, Bay Area people, and it was an effort to use the active duty military as a connecting file between, you know, that thing happening and being able to respond within the next 12 hours as only the active duty military can, and then you know, before the guard gets there. And so, so it's really interesting because most of them had no, we'll see if Jeff. No, that ain't working. Most of them had no idea that we're this, that the active duty component is just like totally self-contained. And their questions were, so are we going to have to feed you? You know, what are we going to have to do for you? And people looking around like, nothing. We'll come with water. We'll come with generators. We'll come with batteries. We'll come with our own porta shitters. You know, we'll come full up round. And they're just looking around like, what? Yeah, all we need really is for you to give us one of your airfields, you know, commercial airports, right? And, we'll be able to work out of that. And so then it was, you know, it was really interesting as they kind of war gamed. They're war gaming the first 48 hours of a huge disaster, right? And one in which their own capability to generate electricity, to generate water and just all the basics of life, you know, they're being overwhelmed. And so, so it was really interesting, but it was really cool, you know, to see General Myatt, to do, you know, in the middle of all that and kind of the driving force behind it. And you know, and I want to say we did that for, you know, 2 years. It's Civ something. I can't remember. I'm trying to think of the name now. But yeah, General Myatt, in the middle of it driving that. And so again, the frustration of units like the 82nd Airborne in Kentucky. I mean, they're, you know, less than an hour flight, you know, from New Orleans. You know, you have Fort Polk in Louisiana. You know, you have in Alabama, you have Rucker, you know, Airfield. You have, so the whole place is ringed by, you know, all this active, and the active units were, dying to help, right? It's because it's one of the cool things that reservists get to use and that reservists get to do. But if you're on active duty, you don't get to, you know, help out in your own country because, it, you know, largely against the law, you know, we're not allowed to do it. And so, you know, there are people dying, you know, like, hey, why can't we take, you know, MAG 39? What do you need? 46s, 53s, and Hueys, you know, and we can use our Cobras to look for people. You know, we go there with our own fuel and, you know, and just give us an airfield. Like, sorry, not, you know, you're not plugged in. And so
my dad was at Parris Island when Hugo hit, and that was a very big storm, and it did considerable damage to the area. And he was lost comms with DC, but after the storm had hit, he started getting a lot of information from Buford, from the local officials asking for help. And he was sending out trucks and generators and stuff like that, and got admonished for it because nobody had told him to.
Right.
You know, he's like, there was, you know, we're talking late 80s, so there wasn't quite the robust comms that you have that we're used to today, but it never occurred to him that he couldn't send out those assets to help out. But there were lawyers involved, and it's like that. There's lawyers involved here, and I think that what General Myatt did subsequent, I mean, it, not because of that, but because of situations like that, is something that we've all wondered about, because one of the things we can do is respond to do that kind of stuff. Hell, it's good for morale.
Oh my God. Yeah. No, it's and to me, you know, the reserve can't get there. And now what you've seen happen, interestingly enough, is let's just use New Orleans as an example. If New Orleans is going to be hit, the reserve components in Texas, in Oklahoma, right, in Arkansas, and you know, in the adjacent states, they're activated. Right, put on alert and ready to go, as opposed, you know, to the affected area having to respond to help itself, and then they'll sort out the money piece later. And so, I mean, I think they've got much more proactive and smart about how they do that. But I mean, the thing in New Orleans, I mean, I don't recall what year it was, but I mean, I was on active duty, and you're just watching it, going, "This is stupid, man. We have all this capacity here to make water, right, to move people." And all those people are down at the Superdome, and nobody can get them water. You know, nobody can lift them out of there. Like, are you shitting me? Like, this is crazy shit. And so, it was cool to see that General Myatt had, you know, had pushed that and say, and look, if we need to ask for, you know, emergency legislation that that the president can sign, you know, that allows the active duty military to be used in humanitarian shit inside. Because look, you know, I mean, well, General Furness, I mean, he was where, when they had the tsunami, he was part of, I want to say, Jeff, I don't know if Jeff was with him or not, but it was on one of his mute floats. I think Jeff might've been the opso.
Jeff was his opso. Yeah.
Right. And they went ashore, and I can't remember the name of the island, but you talked to General Furness, and he's, you know, and he talks about, man, it's just utter devastation. And, you know, your ability to make water, your ability to bring in trucks and move stuff. I mean, it's like there's nothing else there. Right. And all the NGOs, right, they're mobilizing to get there, but they're not going to be there for days.
No, Yeah, and they don't have a whole lot. They don't have that robust capability.
Right.
You know, when we pulled out of
Well, and then I'll tell you what, and then there was another friend of ours, Paul Kennedy. He was the deputy MEF commanding general when, one of the tsunamis hit the Philippines. And he was down in the Philippines responding to that. And it was, it's interesting. And again, it takes days for those capacities, for those things to go. But what happens is, as Marines and sailors, when we're outside the country, we can do that stuff. And then, we can't do it inside our own country, which is frustrating to a lot of people.
No, it is. It is indeed. I was going to say, though, when we pulled out of Beirut, we bought out a bunch of Palestinian civilians, did a neo-op. As a matter of fact, that was the last evolution. We took them to Cyprus, and we came back and backloaded the Marines off the beach. But when that old Guam, that old LPH was, the well deck was full, not the well deck, the hangar bay. I mean, it was overflowing. We had to have at least 4,000 or 5,000 civilians in there, and everybody was turning to, because some of them were sick, some of them were. I delivered a baby. As a matter of fact, there were babies being delivered. It was a major effort, and it was something which everybody enjoyed. Who doesn't like helping kids and women that are in duress?
No, it is no. Yeah. I'll tell you what. I've always said one of the biggest IO things. Jeff Kenny's back with us. You
yes,
good?
I am. Good?
You good now, Coach?
I think so.
All right. One of the biggest IO things we did in Iraq and Afghanistan, and my experience, we did it more so in Afghanistan than we did in Iraq, which was medevacing and saving the lives of civilians. And these people live in Helmand anyway. I mean, they live in mud huts, right? The compounds are dirt walls. And some of the homes are nice, but I mean, it's not, you're not going to get it confused with anything you're going to see in Orange County, California anytime soon. And so, the kids are running around with no shoes on, and then all of a sudden, one of them gets most part of a hand or much of a hand ripped off in some machine they're working on their father's farm. And there happens to be a Marine patrol or something in the area, and they come out and they flag them down. And we medevac this kid, and the father or the uncles has to go with them, and they go from living in the 19th century into one of our booming into a firm base with this surgical suite, right, that they've never seen anything like this, and then they're treated with respect, they're allowed to worship. Right, you have Marines who see little kids, right, and they're giving them sunglasses, they're letting them play their video game, their Game Boys and shit, and they get, like we talked, they give these kids American names, and they're wearing, all of a sudden you see a kid in a, in a Philadelphia Phillies baseball hat who's from Afghanistan, and I often, then they go back to their village, and they hear this shit about, the Americans are this or the Americans are that. But, these people, and you would hear this anecdotally, is that, look, I spent the last 2 weeks with him. Right. All they did was treat me with respect. And they saved his life, And I always thought that was one of the most, our compassion, our willingness to risk our own life, our pilots, going out there and landing and picking people up, that when we didn't have to do that shit, was
I got to tell you, though, we kill ourselves to help them. Particularly when they have dead, getting the dead back within 24 hours so they could be buried, a huge logistical problem. And it doesn't seem to have any effect. They still hate us, man.
Where were you? You were in...
First, I was in RC East.
Right.
And the first time I had a situation like what you're describing, we were doing a convoy with the in the Lagaman province, which is like just north of Nangarhar province, where the Khyber Pass is, where Jalalabad is. So we were doing a convoy with the Army Brigade Commander, and his guys ran over a old dude with a MRAP. So we policed him up, and We have medevaced the guy. I mean, he looked like the guy, the white-haired guy, the guy with the beard from the cover of Kansas, the John Brown cover of Kansas, you know, the rock group. And we had medevaced that guy, and he was shocked and appalled because they stripped him naked to treat him.
Right.
And, you know, so that there was that. And then we medevaced the guy, and you had to have somebody with him the whole time. And right. then when we right. did, you know, we brought him back, and, you know, he was okay. But the I.O. aspect of that is way less than you would think.
Yeah, let me. So I don't know, and I'd be curious to what Timmy says because yeah. he, you know, he was in Helmand and he was up where you were. Timmy,
it was
exactly
where I was. Exactly right.
Right. Were the atmospherics that different because of the proximity?
The atmospherics were 100% different.
Hey, hold on. Hey, your mic's hot again. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me lean back. I'm getting excited again. The atmospherics were different, but to buttress what Jeff just said, I had a friend. Matter of fact, the guy that taught me how to operate in Afghanistan amongst the people in local clothes and whatnot was a physician named Dan Terry, who'd been there since 2000. Since 1994. Him and his wife. He had spoke fluent Pashto and Dari. Everybody knew him. He would go out with other doctors and run clinics and whatnot. And he befriended me. What he asked me to do was I would go up into some of the more distant districts in Nangarhar and bring out kids with a cleft palates, and take them to Kabul. I'd grab them, a male relative, the mother, we'd pile them all in a car, take them to Kabul to get their mouth fixed. Now, Dan Terry, everybody in Afghanistan knew him, yet him and seven others, doctors were ambushed and killed in Badakhshan in the 2010, excuse me. And like I said,
and where is
Dan
that? Well, hold on. Where is that?
Badakhshan is the northern part. If you're looking at a map of Afghanistan, RC East, you know, you got Nangarhar, Kunar, then, Kafiristan. Badakhshan is a little bit of land that juts up in the northern part of
China. Afghanistan,
right up into China. It's a very remote place. But they were targeted and massacred, and I have to wonder because another friend of mine, David Anderson, who was a trauma surgeon, army type there, he was in Kunar and Herat. He said what really bothered his soldiers the most in the trauma business were the children. I said, what children are you talking about? He goes, Afghan children that get hurt or bombed there, or anybody that we scoop up. He goes, we got them every week. A terrible trauma. It was just, and that's what wore out his soldiers more than anything else was the number of damaged children that they had to treat. Because they took all comers towards the in Herat for sure.
Right.
That showed up.
And Timmy met the guy who I advised, Colonel Abzal. And this guy had an issue with his wife. He had one wife, and they had 12 kids. And she was like 42 years old. And his youngest kid at that time was like 6 years old. So, and she was there. He was a Nuristani. In other words, he's like a guy from, he was a guy from the eastern, northeastern part of Afghanistan. They looked German. They looked like Scandinavian almost, you know. And so this guy's wife was going through her change after having 12 kids, and she had like 15 pregnancies, three of them that didn't work out. And she was not acting right. And he's like, I may have to – he's talking to my interpreter, Habibi, and me, and we're going through this. And basically Habibi says, sir, he's afraid he may have to kill his wife because she's just not acting right. And I'm like, oh, fuck. So I'm like – so I had a couple females working for me. It was an eclectic team, you know,
right.
Two Air Force lieutenants. And I said, you go over to the fucking PRT and see if you can find me a female interpreter. I don't know what the fuck to do, but I think I can help this guy. I'm thinking it's a shrink problem. So I go to the Army dude, same guy who ran over that old dude who looked like the guy from Kansas. I said, hey, Colonel Georgia, I got this issue. My guy, I think we can help him here. His wife, I think, is just going through her change, exacerbated by the fact that she's had all these fucking kids. She's had some miscarriages, and now her hormones are acting up, and he's like, she's not acting right. He loves her, but he may have to fucking whack her.
That's what he's saying.
So Habibi, my interpreter, he always refers to her as the patient. I'm trying to kind of get through this shit, you know? And so they find me this woman. I call her the Apache woman because she was a Tajik civilian, Afghan, who worked at the PRT, you know, the Provincial Reconstruction Team.
Right.
You remember that was, Timmy? It was right there on Fob.
Well, how do you get Apache out of that?
Because she looked like it. She had long black hair, and she was like, one of her teeth was black, and she's fucking yelling at me all the time and shit. And so we engineered this thing where I had like 550 cord across the room, this big open room that we divided into cubicles. So I had this shrink that they got from Policharki up there by Kabul. They brought him down, and he's talking to Apache woman. Apache woman's talking to Colonel Avzal's wife, and they figure out she needs fucking hormone medicine. And my two female lieutenant, Lieutenant Page and Lieutenant Malcolm, these two girls were great, you know. They would do anything, you know. I mean, they worked their asses off. And they're like, you know, they're working the whole thing and taking care of her. You would have thought the point of it wasn't so much that we got her help. We got her help, but we did it without fucking humiliating them.
Right.
I don't know if you understand what I mean.
No, exactly.
So,
yeah. Yeah, I know. You did.
So Colonel Avzal was like, you know, it was one of those accidental good things.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So,
right.
So we got her drugs and everything was happy and, you know, we won the war in Afghanistan because of me.
Congratulations. We did something around Fallujah. Actually up in Karma, where in fact Dave was probably there when we did this, but and it was a nerve-wracking thing because we flew in doctors and nurses from Kuwait and all over Iraq to do a medical day for women. Now,
MedCap, MedCap, yeah.
Exactly. And so, and most of these women had never seen a doctor in their lives, right? And so, you know, we announced this, we're working with the village elders and, you know, and the imams and shit, you know, and hey, look, there's only going to be women, but you had to have a shitload of security, right? Because, you know, you're just scared shitless. Whenever you got people together, somebody's going to walk in with a vest and, you know,
and
the Iraqis were, I mean, they were good at it. And so, I mean, all day, right, you're just, you know, you're watching and you're listening and you're, you know, hey, how's everything going? Like, oh, everything's all right. But you're, you know, you're nervous. And so.
Absolutely right.
And so.
You're shitting yourself.
No, really, you are. Because, you know, it's just their ability to use those suicide vests and vehicle-borne IDs is just, to me, was the biggest difference between Iraq and Afghanistan. You were just way more anxiety and on edge in Iraq. Marines came back from that, right? And they're checking in and the whole thing stood down and, you know, whatever, it was a named operation, right? And so, you know, we're putting it to bed and, you know, and they're coming through the COC and you're like, hey, so how'd it go? And Marine after Marine or leader after Marine came by and they were like, it was an unbelievable thing to see.
And you're
like, really? And like, these women were, I mean, some of these things are so basic, but they'd never been looked at by a doctor.
Right.
They never had any kind of basic medicine. And they were so thankful. They were in tears the whole day. And you watch this, and they had their daughters with them who might have something wrong with them. And it was really interesting to listen to the Marines and the corpsmen, you know, who came back were like, it was one of the most emotional days I've ever had here. You know, it was crazy.
And the easy things are dental and the glaucoma shit.
Right.
Because we can deal with that. Yeah, that's something they just think is like a strike from. But I have to tell you, the difference between Jeff Kenney, the OPSO for the 15th New, doing that shit up by the Tigris River, by Mamadia and stuff, and Jeff Kenney, the advisor. By the time I was an advisor, I'm like, we want these motherfuckers to try and fuck with this. That's why we're doing it.
Hey, while you were on your little hiatus here a few minutes ago, were you the OPSO on General Furness's Mew when the tsunami hit?
Yes. Yes, that was horrific.
Talk about now. I just want to give you the context, and then I want you to roll in on it. But you know, we were talking about, you know, one of the frustrating things during Katrina was that ringing Katrina were all these active duty bases with all this full up brown capability, yeah. Right? And that you could have gone now. We could go now, and yeah, we can't do that here in the country. But outside the country, right? We do it all the time.
Yeah, and we tried it. They tried to. The MU just got back, and we were there. We were going to go to Katrina, 15th MU. They go, you guys go. This, the three of the MEF. I go, sir, I got the MU is decompositive. I don't have it. I have 11 fucking Humvees, and that's it, you know?
Right.
But you're right. That's exactly right. When we did what we call, me and Dave call Operation Tsunami Freedom, we were headed towards Guam. And the fucking tsunami rolled underneath us or whatever and smashed Indonesia, Thailand, and part of Sri Lanka, right? And so we went right into Guam and we bought up. We knew we were going there. We bought up the whole fucking, Lowe's that they have there. All kind of shit. Big, huge plastic things that we thought we'd put water in. We figured that'd be an issue. We get out there and the carrier battle group is already there, and they don't have jack shit. But they're filming themselves flying those shitty little 60s around that can drop, like, you know, five water cans to somebody if they need it and shit.
Right, right.
We got 453s, 1246s, three fucking Hueys, and, you know, three Cobras. We're, you know, and those aren't worth a fuck. But plus all that landing gear. We fucking worked our ass off for about 3.5 weeks, and Dave will tell you about this. There wasn't too much for the BLT to do, but that fucking Indonesia, I never saw so many dead people in my life floating in the fucking water, because it went in there in the low, like Banda Aceh and Mulabo and a couple other places. It went all the way. It was like sea level terrain. I don't know if you know what I mean, but it just, the tsunami just rolled right in. There's no cliffs. I'm looking down here at the beach right now from my apartment, you know, or what would be if it wasn't dark. And, you know, you got those bluffs and everything that goes up. There's none of that in Indonesia. It's just flat. So that tsunami rolled over and then it takes all these people and pulls them back out to sea and drowns them. And then they come floating back in by the hundreds of thousands. So we were doing all kind of stuff. We almost lost helicopters because, like, there'd be a little pimple of high ground crowded with people, and the 46s, you know, we had this elaborate relief plan. Every night we'd slave all night doing it, you know, ATO and shit like that, and next day would be to shit in 45 minutes.
Because
of all the distress calls, you know, in the coast of Indonesia.
Explain ATO.
It's the air tasking order, which assigns aircraft towards missions every day on a naval, off of naval shipping, you know?
So, yeah. No, I remember talking to Dave, and he said, I've never seen anything like it. He said,
yeah,
bodies everywhere. He said, bodies in trees, bodies, I mean, every
awful.
Yeah, he said, everything, it was just horrific. And so, you know, you do that overseas, but you come home and you see these disasters at home, and you know, you're not allowed to help. And so that's what was cool about General Myatt and his involvement in the Bay Area and whatnot. So anyway, I want to switch gears. I want to talk about where you get your news, right? And I'm particularly talking about, you know, foreign news. How do you collect that? Timmy, you're a reader.
When we first started this, the first time I came on, I think you asked me this question. And at the time, I had a routine that hadn't deviated in a decade, which was my homepage was Drudge. I would get up, I would look at the Drudge Report, and then I would go to a series of other websites. I no longer do that. I'm embarrassed to tell you this, Matt, but the fact of the matter is, most of the interesting stuff I find is on my highly procured Facebook feed. Of guys putting in articles that look interesting. I no longer look at the Drudge Report. I don't basically pay much attention to the news at all anymore. And as we've talked about, back when I was younger, I was a voracious reader of consumer political news. I mean, I was was my passion.
You're the first Rush Limbaugh guy I ever met.
That's right. I don't listen to him either. I don't. I get up. I will look at the Powerline blog, which is written out of Minnesota by a bunch of lawyers who are pretty interesting fellas. I'll look for anything that Victor Davis Hanson has written, and he's prolific.
Yeah,
anything that Richard Fernandez has written, and then I'll go check an aggregator to see if there's anything in there that piques my interest. And to be honest, Mac, where I used to spend a good 2-3 hours a day catching up on news and reading about current events, I don't spend a half hour now. I get done looking at that crap and start writing because I'm tired of looking at the news. It's when I want to find something out, I have to do a lot of research to get comfortable with it.
And that's interesting.
Because I don't trust the news. I don't trust what they're telling me.
Let me refine the question. Specifically about foreign events, do you read outside? Do you go outside the country for foreign sources, for perspective? Do you do any of that?
I do. I've got this Mario Profascia aggregator where I pull this up and it's guys out of Estonia or something. I hit Afghanistan and will pull up everything on Afghanistan. I can go country by country. So I will pull that up, like in preparation for today, and knowing we're going to talk about Iran, I'll pull it up to see if there's anything in Iran or Afghanistan that I'm interested in. But unless I'm looking for it, I tend not to see it because I just am not, I don't like being consumed by the news. And I don't like the fact that Facebook gives me so much of my news, but it does.
That's amazing, though.
That's scary.
I don't know, Timmy. I'm going to ask if you could send me some of those links like that other thing. Because I'm getting the same frustration with a lot of the news now, and especially Drudge, you know, for sure.
All right. What about you, Jeff? Where do you go? And I'm more talking global perspective than I am talking, you know, current domestic events.
Yeah. Well, I did go to Drudge, and then I go to Breitbart, and I'm looking at certain subscribers. I'm John Nolte and Dellingpole. Those guys usually don't steer me wrong, you know, on eclectic bunch of subjects, everything from foreign affairs type things down to movie reviews, you know. I'm feeling a frustration of I'm feeling the frustration that Timmy just, you know, elucidated. You know, I mean, I'm not getting what I really want. You know what I'm saying? I get my best stuff. I have to tell you, there's this the Wexford Group, the guys I work for, they also do the Quiet Professionals. They send these former special ops guys and stuff to. They tell me shit. You know what I mean? They tell me shit, not classified stuff, but you know, they tell me. Like what's going on over in RC Southwest, what's going on over in Iraq a little bit. And they tell me personally, because they come back here, the Marine Corps has them come and talk to the teams and stuff. It's a pretty good deal.
But
you're right. It's a frustration. I don't feel like I'm getting it right. I feel like I'm not being told.
And guys, check this out. I mentioned, I think, a month ago that ISIS in Nangarhar had been taken out and beaten to a pulp by the Taliban. The Taliban, I've seen it. That did in fact occur. I even saw it in the Military Times, an article about it. But that seems to be a significant event. But how would you know? How would anybody even know that it happened?
All we were hearing before
was ISIS is in Afghanistan. ISIS is everywhere. Blah blah blah. Now they're nowhere. But there's no visibility on it. You've got to hunt for that news.
I mean, the idea that, like, what Mac is saying about getting on Al Jazeera is almost the best way to do it, and then reverse engineer from what they say, along with any kind of personal sources, like you're saying to me, that you have, to find out what's really happening, to get kind of like a clear view.
Right.
I remember General Mattis in, like, 2006, 2007 saying, why aren't we able to get our guys in Al Jazeera? You know, he was in the MEF. He was a MEF guy saying that. I'm thinking, fuck, I'd like to see what those assholes are saying.
Right.
You know, and,
right.
you know,
Right. Well, no, I just, Timmy said, you know, he was, you know, right when it was happening a couple weeks ago, you know, when we were talking, he started talking about how and why the memorial or the vigils turned into protests. And so as I've, you know, I thought, you know what, I, you know, there's a lot of good content out there by a lot of Iranians, you know, and some of them go on Al Jazeera, some of them don't. And so that's what I played, you know, yesterday on the show is, you know, I played some of that. And I'll tell you what, it's pretty interesting stuff. But again, I think that, and as you guys have been alluding to, that kind of wets your whistle then to drill down to other people, and you may or may not, you may or may not appreciate the perspective. The same thing I did with, you know, the interview with the president of Taiwan. You know, and well, you know, what is the Taiwanese media putting out? And then I saw the BBC interview with her, and I started watching it.
Absolutely.
And so it was very interesting, the interview itself, but it was equally as interesting the bias of the guy interviewing her was, was asking her like China owned Taiwan, and you're like,
dude. Amazing. So you're getting more from the type of shit questions the guy's giving her than you are from what she's saying.
Right.
Because it's like you're not even reporting on her. You're reporting on him reporting on her because that's an indicator. That's even a more important indicator of the problems that could happen.
Right. And it's just like this Western bias that somehow or other mainland China owns Taiwan, and they never have. And the guy, you know, is keeps kind of poking her about you keep, you know, you want to go to this antagonistic relationship with China. And she says, no, I don't.
Yeah.
They have changed the game. They threaten this country every single day. And it doesn't stop.
Exactly
so,
right.
And so, like, you're sitting there watching it. You're sitting there watching, and you're like, "Holy shit, man!" But that's why I wanted to ask you guys, because to me, the importance of that perspective is, you know, it changes the way you do view the world. And you know, I need to do, you know, I'm kind of interested now to, to watch, you know, content, you know, maybe in English from Vietnam, maybe, you know, and I think it, whether it's all valid or not, is not so much important as is the different perspective and things you're going to hear in it.
So I have to tell you, that's a huge thing, what you just said about, like, Vietnam. If we just treat those people the way, take out anything that happened prior to 1975 and just treat them the way that, you know, that's in a way that's within our best interest and within their best interest, so much shit will come out about what happened during Vietnam that we never even knew between them and the Chinese and the Soviets. It'll be like a gold mine. You know what I mean? The United States is always the best bet for everybody, even if you were your enemy. You know what I mean?
No, it's the truth, right? I mean, it's
this, absolutely right.
This, it's a sad truth, but and again, and Grant Newsham is like, I mean, I thank God that I don't even know how I crossed paths with him now after all these years, but he has educated me so much, you know, and Grant was out there, you know, talking about Iron Fist and the Japanese amphibious capability before it was ever even remotely cool, right? He was just like, yeah, that weird dude talking about that shit. Right? And now it's the end thing. And I saw somebody wrote a story in Stars and Stripes about him. And, it's pretty interesting. Pretty interesting. No, but I just find it, you know, we're all kind of, you know, readers and consumers and we've been around the world and we've been to, you know, the Far East and we've been to the Middle East. And so I always find it interesting because of, you know, again, Timmy's comments and he got it, and now you can sit and listen to Al Jazeera tonight. You know, you go to YouTube, you'll see their nightly broadcast. And again, it's not our perspective, which I think is very important. All right, next subject. The Quds have a new head. Talk to me about significant, not significant. Timmy, you have some thoughts about the guy.
Timmy has good info on that.
Yeah, it's Ismail Kwani.
Okay, hold on. Hey, you got to do something where you don't lean in your microphone, man.
Oh God, I'm so sorry. Yeah. So at any rate, the Major General Ismail Kwani is the new head of the Quads Force, and in July of 2018, he was in Bamiyan Province in Afghanistan, which is in the central part of the country, and it is a complete. It's all Hazara people. They are Shia, not Sunni, as are the Pashtuns and the other right. tribes in Afghanistan.
Absolutely right.
And he was there basically pretending to be a minor official from the embassy, talked to the provincial governor, talked to some other business people. We don't know what they talked about, but remember now the Quds Force has at least a brigade of Afghan Hazaras, Shias, fighting for them over in Syria, and obviously he's looking for probably looking for some more manpower, I would imagine, because I've been up in Bamiyan about 10 years ago, and it is 100% Hazara. It's 100% safe. New Zealand were the troops up there, and they patrolled in soft cars and soft covers. I mean, sure. They didn't even take weapons. Yeah, yeah. That's how quiet Bamiyan was.
Bamiyan is where those colossuses that the Taliban dynamited. If you remember that.
Yeah.
No, I went and climbed in where they're trying to assemble the pieces. I went and toured all through that where they're trying to restore what they can. But Bamiyan's a beautiful place. It's six months out of the year.
So just so everybody knows, let's kind of wire diagram the Quds in terms of the Revolutionary Guard in Iran. Explain the Quds Force to me.
Okay, the Quds Force basically is their special forces of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. They came into existence battling Saddam Hussein and the Iraqis back during the Iran-Iraq War. They now have. But basically, they are the senior leadership of the Iranian national of the Revolutionary Guard. The Quds Force, the head of the guard comes out of the Quds Force. All the senior guys, I would assume, are in some way, shape, or form related to the Quds Force. And what the Quds Force does is go overseas outside of Iran and try to kill Americans, mostly.
And the big thing about them that is significant is during that desperate time, that World War One type fight in the mid-80s between Iran and Iraq, those Quds Force guys, they had the presence of mind to send them to Lebanon. They're the basic architects of Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that one of their guys is that guy that starts with an M, Mohegada or whatever, that did the bomb that destroyed the Marine, the BLT in the, you know, for 1-8 in 1983. They're the ones that hit the embassy 6 or 7 months before that. So even though they're in that desperate struggle against the Iraqis in the 80s, they still were sending those guys forth, if you know what I mean. They've always had the long view, and they use the Al-Quds Force to exercise that long view for sure.
And that's an excellent point. And again, I think their goal is to get hegemony, to be the hegemon in the Middle East. And of course, they're obviously supporting their co-religionists, which are Shia in Lebanon, Shia in Afghanistan. I don't think it's Shia in Iraq.
Shia in Iraq.
Yeah.
The one of the things I saw on the report talked about the protest in Iraq, and you saw Shiite militia leaders in southern Iraq, right, who are, you know, certainly pro-Iranian leading, but calling for the withdrawal of all forces, American and Iranian forces, from Iraq, which I thought was pretty interesting because it's not something, you know, we've talked about that before. It's not something, you know, you see, and certainly kind of raises some eyebrows. After watching a few days of Al Jazeera, one of the things that's interested me is that, you know, make no mistake about it, the Iranian regime is under an incredible amount of pressure. And one of the
Absolutely.
Things, right, that happened late last week was Boris Johnson, right, and even Emmanuel Macron said if they completely abandon the JCPOA, then we will have no other option but to, you know, to renew our sanctions. And that is the exact opposite of, you know, of what they were trying to do, right? They were trying to drive a wedge between the United States and Europe, have Europe come to its aid, these unreasonable American jackasses, and now all of a sudden the thing's flipped over, and Europe might reinstitute its sanctions on Iran. And so they're in an extremely difficult place. So it's been pretty interesting because that comes through loud and clear on Al Jazeera.
Hey, you know what was interesting to me was I listened to Joe Rogan talking to, he had a guest on, a guy by the name of Mike Baker. He's a former CIA case officer.
Oh, yeah. He's on TV.
Interesting fella. Yeah, interesting fella. He's got a TV show coming out, and that's what but what Baker had to do was talk Rogan out of it. This is so funny. Because they get on, and Joe goes, oh, so what's up with Iran? Are we going to have World War III or what? And Baker's like, no. And it took him like a half hour to 45 minutes just to get Joe to understand that if we go to war with Iran, Iran's done. And Rogan's not an idiot. Rogan's a pretty smart guy. Not that smart on the military stuff because he's not interested in it, but he's a very well-informed guy. And and he doesn't even have a grasp on really what's at stake here and what's at play and what's happening. I'm just pointing that out because I heard you read, Mac, some comments from readers that said our discussions have been the most illuminating. And I mean, compared to the biggest podcast on earth, we're like light years ahead of them. But it was hysterical to me to listen to how worried Rogan was. And then when Baker goes, no, we'd sink their Navy in about 30 minutes. And Rogan goes, really? Yeah. It's interesting.
I've received a number of emails about a number of things. One is our discussion about why the Iraqis can't have us leave, right? Not only do they need, you know, they like our money, but they need us relative to the security piece. And so the theatrics of the non-binding resolution, you know, that whether the American media is just stupid or whether you get more clicks if you really pump it up, I'm not exactly sure. But they said it was, you guys just laid it out, and then watching on TV, it like unfolds like you guys are saying. You know, it's crazy. And then the other discussion about, you know, the not so retaliation and why they would not do it and whatnot. And they said, you know, that was the most detailed explanation that they had heard anywhere. And so the people were, but again, we've lived deep for years in those places.
Yeah.
And you've seen, again, I used to see it in Fallujah, right? And, you know, something would happen, right? And there would be all the bloviating, and God forbid Al Jazeera would show up or somebody would show up with a camera, and then it lasts even longer, and they're, you know, and it's all made for TV event. Right?
When I was in Afghanistan doing, writing my poorly written blog, I got a lot of attention, and I used to go on Russian television. They had me on there, about 10 times or so. over a course of a year, the Alana show, and she was good looking too. It's hard to concentrate. Yeah, she. But I would go on the show and they would let me run for
sister,
six
man.
7 minutes. Yeah, no, they let me go on for 6 or 7 minutes, and I was, for instance, they talking about contracting. I was telling her the argument's ridiculous. There's not that many contractors in the real monies. Is it cleaning out shitters, not in the security industry? That's a loser. That's what losers do with security stuff. I only mention that because Russian television, you know, a propaganda arm, but some of these outlets will have people on and they'll let you talk. And they let me go for 5 or 6 minutes at a time. It was kind of fun.
My big regret, Timmy, is I never went to that fucking hotel and had a drink. God damn it.
I would have felt bad if you had done it. I would have slept you off and did it, but I
what hotel?
I Oh, never mind. I was going to tell you who I did
I'll let
sneak
Timmy
off.
Tell you about it.
Never mind.
Never mind. Exactly.
tell that story.
Andy Milburn was on, and so Jeff, let me tee this up for you. Andy's in Somalia right now teaching, and a couple interesting things he had to say. One, he's going to teach a module or speak at Command and Staff about the moral obligation of an officer, right, to dissent, which Andy's written about. I can't remember the name of the piece that he wrote. I wish I could. I think it was in the Long Wars manual. Mm-hmm. I'll find it here in a minute. But I thought, you know what? And I made this comment. I said, you know, hats off to Command and Staff for doing that. I mean, they don't have to do that. So good on them for doing it. And then the other thing that Andy brought up was, as he said, look, this is nothing classified, he said, but I'm a little disturbed here in Somalia, you know, where you see, you know, our soft guys very restricted in terms of leaving firm bases. And we think that we're somehow or other secure because we stay in the firm base. So let me tee that one up for you, Jeff. And then maybe contrast that between a more mature theater, you know, like Hellman and Task Force Southwest that has more robust capabilities, and then those that are alone and unafraid in a place like Somalia.
It's like we taught it so many times in IOC. You got to patrol in the D. You got to get out of the fucking perimeter. You got to, otherwise you're going to get slammed. I mean, so this is just it's a different version of that. You know what I mean? You can't just be locked up in that firm base and think that you're safe.
In an effort to prohibit or to limit casualties, right? We said no.
You get more.
And again, as a direct result of what happened in Africa, right? Everybody gets their wings clipped, right? Because we can't support you. So the way we're going to prohibit that is we're going to keep you here.
Right. And then even if you don't suffer the casualties, you just fail.
Explain.
You don't provide any influence that's positive against the enemy. You know what I mean? You don't, because you're timid and you're locked up behind your little fort, your fortress, you don't influence the population in any way. You don't provide them security. You don't provide a good image of, of competent U.S. forces out there. All you do is you're hunkered down waiting to get hit, and everyone sees that. You know, it's like it's the whole firm base mentality. The whole mentality is just wrong. Sure. It's counterintuitive to think that it's right. You know what I mean? Or to think that it's not right, but it isn't right, you know? If you want to be in the defense, we all learned it as lieutenants. James Webb and Oliver North and all these guys would come and talk to lieutenants when the graduation breakfast. You got to fucking patrol. You got to be outside the D. And now outside the D happens in a lot of different ways than just doing a contact patrol or doing an ambush or a listening post. It happens in other ways, but you got to be outside touching the population, because the population is the goal. You know that.
I'll tell you the result of this. This is I had a conversation with a guy I worked with in Jalalabad. He was a Pashto guy, religious, observant Muslim, pretty much a center road. But he said, you know, the problem with the Americans is you're cowards. And I'm like, what? You're cowards. When the Russians were here, they would come out to the soldiers when they weren't on patrol. They'd come out to the bazaar and they'd buy food and they would interact with civilians and whatnot. You people stay behind a wall. We never see you. The only time we see you, you're running and forcing our cars off the road and shit like
That's exactly right.
You guys are cowards. And it was hard for me to muster a counter argument because, I mean, that's why I started writing that blog. I was so disgusted with what I was seeing up in RC East. It wasn't anything like we talked about when we were captains planning for eventualities which were similar to what we found ourselves in. But that's what happens from the civilian's perspective looking in. You're all buttoned up on your firm base. I know that the National Command Authority thought we were doing good by separating us from the Muslim population because they're so touchy. You know, we'll say something wrong or insult their women something like that.
Which
is partially true, partially untrue. Afghans aren't stupid. They know when you're joking.
Yeah, but I don't agree. I don't think that's what we were doing when we did that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
the thing about it is, though, you're right, Timmy, because it's like when they're in Vietnam, they're coalescing with the population where is appropriate. We could have done that in places like Assadabad and Jalalabad, and all you need to do is be a little bit smart.
Yeah.
But the problem is this. I'll tell you right now, no commander is going to – that General Order 1 is basically there to protect the careers of people who are in command, and that's it.
Right.
It's not there for any tactical reason.
Explain. First of all, talk about General Order 1 and then explain what you mean.
General Order 1 to me and most Marines and soldiers who are ever in Afghanistan or Iraq means no fucking and no drinking in country while you're on a deployment to Iraq or Afghanistan. In other words, you're not to have sex with people of the service or anybody else, and you're not supposed to go out and drink. If booze can be brought in, you don't drink it. You don't do anything like that, and the reason is because it could relate. It leads to a lessening of self-discipline. This is an ostensible reason. It leads to a lessening of self-discipline and could lead to embarrassing incidents that hurt the overall counterinsurgency battle for hearts and minds that we're waging, which sounds reasonable, but I didn't mind not drinking over there. I didn't really feel the need to get drunk or anything like that when I was over there doing that. But I have to tell you, the whole point of it was I didn't really think it was a enemy focused thing or even a friendly population focused thing. It was a thing to protect the military from doing embarrassing things that would be reported negatively in the press. That's what I thought.
They would adversely affect the careers of general officers. Right.
And none of our allies did that. All the allies, they were booted.
I would say, I mean, our allies, most of them, I mean, they were over there collecting paychecks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they got assigned. And so
that's true.
I don't know that that's a fair comparison because they were there. I mean, it was like an unholy event if any of them got killed. Right.
Right.
We are now, general officers exist now where everything they do is going to get reported on.
Right.
And I would say they're a conformist group by nature.
Absolutely.
Now.
Yeah.
And I can just tell you my experience with, post-traumatic winning. If the PhD says, I don't think so. The general says, okay, whatever. Not doing it. Right, man.
And some of these generals have years of real-world experience, and some fucking jerk-off who just was in – who wrote a good paper, when he was going from his master's degree to his PhD. That guy is going to – that's what a lawyer really is when you think about it, the same type of thing. It's the same deal. They negate all their experience. That's why it doesn't bother
them. To
have civilians tell them what to do from the Pentagon.
Right. And then what happens is, the general officer asks themselves, right, am I going to risk the franchise for this?
Right.
Not me. All right. So seemed like a good idea. And I think, it appeals to the leader in me. But if my PhD says, nah, not so much, I'm not going to step in front of the PhD because if anything goes wrong, right, if anything goes wrong, it's on me then.
Right.
And
I have to tell you, and a guy like that will never prevail, never, ever prevail against a guy who just says, fuck this, I'm going to do what I think. I'm going to – a guy who's like not picked by a board of, a gender-neutral – gay-friendly board of good people, who pick a guy. a guy who rises up through the fucking ranks because he's a recognized psychopath or he's a recognized effective, you know, user of violence. That's what our enemies are. You know, that's why they're. That's why.
Did you say an effective? So did you say an effective psychopath?
Yes. Yeah. This guy Soleimani rose through the ranks.
Oh, that.
Of a bunch of bloodthirsty people.
Right.
You know?
That's not our.
Because he's effective.
That's not our. That's not our metric, and that's not our system. And yeah, I'll tell you what's amazing.
We always lose to these guys.
That's
up to a certain point.
You want to know what was amazing to me? Who's the vice chair? The vice chair.
Yeah. Right. I heard that. His thing about how we don't have risk takers.
No.
We're afraid to fail.
But he was accused of sexual harassment, right? That lieutenant colonel.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh man, they put his appointment on hold. The fact that he even survived that, in this day and age, was, in my opinion, miraculous.
He's a hero to me.
Because normally, right? Normally, the mere accusation derails the guy, and you're expected to withdraw your nomination. And he said, I'm not doing it. And so then they investigated, and they said, ultimately, at the end of the investigation, they said, we cannot find one bit of corroborating evidence right to this.
And that's a shocker.
Well, I know, especially when the Senate, with Kristen Gillibrand and on there and Elizabeth Warren, right, they are spring-loaded for that shit. And he was ultimately confirmed. So, but again, the point of Article 1 is it risk-taking? You know, not so much, because that, you know, is going to destroy the franchise. And there was, you know, it's interesting because you'll see guys in scholarly articles about commanders in World War II. You might get fired, but, you know, they didn't run you out of the service. They gave you another job that you could handle.
Terry Allen. Right. Terry Allen.
Yeah.
Big Red One. He becomes the father of the fucking modern night attack.
Right.
That's right.
Because, you know, and you're absolutely right. It's like, but that's when people weren't paying attention so much to what happened in the grubby Army and the grubby Marine Corps and the grubby Navy.
Right, right.
Now it's like it's an easy way to make a name for yourself. Look at Kristen Gillibrand. You mentioned her yourself.
Well, think about this. Nimitz at the Battle of Leyte Gulf.
Yeah.
I mean, the American disinformation campaign – post-World War II to preserve Nimitz, even though that everybody knew that
You're talking Halsey, not Nimitz.
Halsey, right.
Yeah, right.
Right.
But Nimitz was protecting Halsey.
Right.
And King is like, fuck him. I'm sick of all these guys having fun. I want his ass.
Right.
And, you know,
and
they
just tell him, hey, Bull, right? Your new nickname's bullshit, okay? You just shut the fuck up for the rest of the war. And we're not all going to pull your pants down in public, okay?
And he says, you think that's good? You think what I did in Leyte Gulf is good? Wait till you see what I do with this fucking, typhoon. I'll even fuck up the work. You know, I mean, it's like funny as shit. Almost.
But now it's like, you know, everything from your emails to your whatever you say is going to go on the nightly news tonight. And so, I mean, what is that? I mean, does that raise the bold and audacious leader? And then even, you know, I think the most frustrating part, to go back to Andy's discussion about being, you know, that withdrawing into firm base is not security. And I said, you know, Andy, one of the things that was most disturbing about what happened in Afghanistan is, look, we put people out there and we don't have the fucking common sense to say – we can get to them in the golden hour, right, for a medevac. We can get them close air support in an hour. We don't have that capability. Then how the fuck do we stick them out there? Who's doing this? Because we're better than that. And if you want to assert American power in the region, you know, might we have to stand up a node here? Right? That is a airhead, you know, and a logistics head. We're going to QRF out of there. We're going to, you know, and if we're not willing to make that commitment, then don't have those guys hang their ass out there. How the fuck could that have even happened?
You're right. You're right. So you're out there, Dwyer. You know, you know what I'm talking about. How many guys got killed because we wanted to have nice relations with the Brits?
Where are we talking about?
In Helmand.
Oh, dude, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. because the Brits had their way of doing things and we had our way. Well, one of the big glaring examples is the attack on the Harriers that killed the squadron commander and one of its sergeants.
Right.
Typical, total, and then even it never got fixed, even though we fired General Sturtevant, ruined General Gerganus. Neither of them had anything to do with security for that part of the base. Even if they wanted to, they couldn't have affected it. As a matter of fact, it even got worse after that with the Brits. Because I was there, you know?
Yeah,
awful.
I wasn't up there.
But there's something else about that, Mac.
Timmy, back away from your fucking mic there, butthead.
God damn it. I have to get an invisible barrier. But there's something else about that. Now, when you guys, out of Leavenock, when you were in the Hellman, you know, you were also responsible for, not you, as in the first Marines, but the Meth Ford was responsible for Nimrod's province, right? And so they wanted to do a lot of work down there. And basically they did it through me because I could move down there and I was working out there anyway for USAID. But after I left Nimrod's, after we finished our projects, the G9 sent a bunch of Marines down there anyway. I'm not sure what, but they were mimicking what I did, only they were wearing uniforms and right in the AMP cars, and they got hit. And they were not anywhere close to, there was no hour medevac. Those guys, it took a while to recover them. My point being that if every time you send somebody a little bit outside your artillery fan, you're setting up another artillery fan or you're moving up assets to support them, I don't think that makes us so expensive to deploy that we're almost useless.
No,
you know what I mean?
I'm not talking about moving guns and stuff like that. There's other ways to protect those people. But if you can't do that, you're just going to hang their ass out there? Like,
that's what they did with 2-7. In 2008, 2009, remember?
Up north
in Hellman?
Yeah.
Hellman and into Nimrud. I mean, they were scattered. They were spread way the hell out there.
Yeah, you talk to those guys about guys who fought, who were virtually ignored and slugged it out. I mean, some of the stories you read about that deployment are like, holy shit, man. Holy shit. So let me just say this. What bothers me about this stuff, right, is that General Waldhauser, he'd never held accountable for it, right? That's his command. You've got guys out there, and so what he should have been able to say is one of two things, right? First of all, we failed, and it's my responsibility, and I accept complete responsibility because we're better than this. Or he should have said, we were not able, right, to do that. But these missions were so significant, in my opinion, that I assumed the risk, and therefore all of this.
General Waldhauser, when was this? Are you talking about 2011?
No. This is an AFRICOM.
Oh, AFRICOM, right.
Right, right. So to me, he's got to make one of those two statements, right? To me, the Polish salute, like, well, we don't know, like, like, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, Waldhauser's not that type of. I mean. I don't know, man.
As the CG, right, and you have these things scattered all over the place, to me, right, you're the guy who gives the guidance to your three. Hey, this is going to be the conditions relative to medevac and relative to close air support that we've got to be able to fulfill to stick these guys out there, right? Yeah. If not, right, then how do we help them when they scream, fuck, right, we're fucking surrounded. Yeah. You know, what do we say? Good luck? Hey, good luck. Put your earplugs in. I mean, come on. So to me, that's the whole conundrum of special forces. So I'm not talking about moving guns and artillery fans, but there are other ways, from drones to other ways, if you're going to hang people's ass out there, that you can protect them. And if you're not willing to do that, then obviously whatever you're doing isn't, you know, worth the inconvenience to put, you know, a section of of Cobras down at a more southern firm base for the afternoon while these guys go do this shit?
I think the word should be out there that, like, sometimes the Americans put guys out there with no golden hour. And because they do that, you better watch it. Even if we don't do it. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
It's like, I don't believe that we should do the Geneva Convention stuff anymore at all. We shouldn't say we're going to abide by these things that are in the Geneva. We shouldn't say it. We shouldn't say we're not going to do it, but we shouldn't say we're going to do it. because it's a weakness, because no one else does it. It's just stupid. It's like something we do to make ourselves feel good.
Specifically, when you say Geneva Convention, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about killing prisoners and torturing prisoners. We should say, we're going to do with them what we're going to do, what we think's best. That's it. We may torture them. We may kill them. We may fucking mutilate them. We may not. But that's our business. We're not saying. We should say that because that's what everyone else does. And then you cannot do it if you don't want to, if it hurts your feelings or whatever. But what I'm saying is we do a lot of stupid shit for public consumption that hurts us. We actually take it seriously.
Well, you have General Mattis saying that, you know, he can get more out of a prisoner with this, you know.
Yeah, I disagree.
Well, you know,
you're not going to get shit out of Mattis by giving him a beer and cigarette.
Well, and I disagree with it too, and under these conditions. So we yoke somebody up, and we believe they have time-sensitive operational information, and we're not gonna put the screws to them. And Marines are gonna get killed. You know, you have to.
And so ambiguity is your friend. I mean, ambiguity is your friend. You don't say yay or nay. You just don't say shit. You just say I'm not necessarily, abiding by these protocols anymore. And then. Because right now these fuckers think I got yoked up. I'm good to go. I'm gonna have a nice vacation in the tropical paradise of Guantanamo Bay. You know, I'm gonna be fine. And now there's uncertainty. I mean, even now there is uncertainty now because they may get sent to fucking some Egyptian hellhole. You know, during a rendition or something like that. But I wouldn't even say that. I'd say, hey, look, and this guy's the president to do it too. I'm not saying we're going to do this shit anymore because no one else does. And then show some pictures of some of the guys that we saw when they uncovered those hell houses in Fallujah in 2004 in November.
Oh,
you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Let them see that and say, hey, look, fuck this.
Well, that's what's in my head. And again, I believe that applies very narrowly, right, in terms of operational information that is time sensitive. So I believe that you know what I'm saying? And but I disagreed with that, you know, and then General Mattis comes out and says, yeah, I think, and people are like, oh, Mac, you know, General Mattis. I said, look, I mean, you bring this dude to me and we know he's a planner. He's an ops guy. And we know based on our SIGINT that they're planning on something and he's just gonna sit there and we're not gonna put the screws to him. You think I'm going to do that? And then how do I look the families of Marines that get killed because I wanted to be nice to this guy and smoke cigarettes with him?
Right.
If he's not talking, then we're going to make him talk. You know,
that's what I mean. Ambiguity is your friend, man.
Right.
And on top of that, the effectiveness doesn't come from the torture. It's the tension leading up to just like you're saying, Jeff, it's the ambiguity and these enhanced techniques work best when the guy doesn't know exactly what the hell is going to happen to him. Because, I mean, we go to great lengths not to hurt anybody. I mean, we waterboard ourselves when we go through escape and survival school.
Right. You know? I just got to tell you guys, I raised my three boys, right? They're like three fucking insane fighting midgets, constantly fighting. I had them holding up kitchen chairs and shit, you know? Put them in the push-up position. And the only thing that worked was they didn't know how long I was going to have them hold a chair or be in the push-up position. You know what I'm saying? They're just it's like Timmy was saying. It's the idea of that not knowing how long – you know, and one of my kids had a lot of imagination. He's thinking, I could be here for an eon, you know. I could be here till the turn of the century. So he cracks first, you know. But it's like
The other thing I think that we should stress more than we don't is our enemies are in their greatest peril when they're facing our guns. When they're out there and we're fighting, that's when they're in their greatest peril. If we get our mitts on them, they're as safe as they're going to be at any point in the rest of their life. They will not be safer. It's the exact opposite when we're fighting them. When they're shooting at us, that's not exactly a big threat. Yeah, they can throw up some bombs and they get good every once in a while, but they generally don't hit shit. But if we get captured by them, then we're in gravest peril ever.
Dichotomy. I'll tell you something, both you guys. I don't have it in me to kill a helpless person, even if he's a shithead. I mean, I just don't see it in me, you know, without being really fucking emotional about it. But why does he got to know that before we take him? You know what I mean? Why does he got to know what I'm going to do, what I'm not going to do? Why does he owe, why do we owe him that? Let's put that in, let that uncertainty sit in there, fester in his mind, and maybe help us, and maybe save some of our guys, you know?
Again, I think you have a moral obligation to use whatever means that you have at your disposal to protect the people who you've raised your hand. And you know, so again, in the case in my head, right, we have other intelligence and pieces of mosaic, and we grab this guy, and then what, do we Mirandize him and say, yeah, take him to the hotel, and we'll come over, and we'll have dinner, and maybe he'll tell us. You know, fuck that. Right? I just never, ever believed that. Now, you know, we can quarrel with the techniques. We can quarrel with all that shit. But I do believe that between the uncertainty that you create and the discomfort you create, you know, you have to exhaust your means. But again, you had John McCain, right, who was tortured and kept in solitary confinement for years. You had, you know, General Mattis stand up and say the same thing. And so, I mean,
John McCain gave the enemy what they wanted, because there's no way you can hold out. You know what I mean? So he gave them what they wanted. You know, it's like I don't shit on him for that. I pray. It's like we talked about these Vietnam POWs so much.
Right.
You could never. It's amazing they did what they did.
Right.
But, well, you know, they were totally at the mercy of the enemy, and the enemy had no qualms about using them to their advantage, and they did it. All I'm saying is, why do we give away that huge advantage when, like you're saying, Mac, there's our guys' lives are at stake, you know?
And not only that, but remember when we had Cleek D. Giovanni, we used to do that.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about this, where we'd stage an NBC assault, and then we'd grab
Dr.
a couple
D,
guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, and how easy was it to break a lieutenant? All you had to do was put his roommate in a tub, you know, buck naked, standing in a tub for 12 hours. In an oil can, which D. Giovanni did himself before he did that to our lieutenants.
I remember him telling us that. Remember that? We were like, General or Colonel Allen busted out laughing.
Yeah, I know. It was hysterical. But every class, we broke the lieutenants. It wasn't even very difficult.
No.
You know, stripping down naked and make with in front of WMs. That was one of the ones we did.
You know, I don't know how we as a nation articulate that, and because you don't have general officers that are willing to go there, right?
I mean, because
the hue and cry, first of all, the debate, you know, you would have the General Mattises and the John McCains. I mean, those guys are titans inside the DOD. But I'll tell you what, if it was Captain McNamara or Lieutenant Colonel McNamara or Colonel McNamara that was out there and making the decision, and my 2 and 3 walk in and say, hey, sir, we've got this guy, and we're going to have to use extraordinary measures, I'd say do it. And again, I would gladly, you know, be sent home and face a court martial. But I would look at the parents and the wives and the children of my Marines and said, I did everything I could while I was in charge.
Right. I think you just described Alan West, I think, right there.
That's exactly who I was thinking of. That's
Alan
exactly
West,
who
man.
I was thinking.
And so, yeah. I
met him a couple of times. Alan West is a good dude. I met him in Kandahar when he was out working as an advisor.
And so, yeah, I think we've all thought about this stuff a lot, and we've read about it a lot. But, you know, to me, the waterboarding, like, months after the fact, it's like, I mean, come on. That's like, to me, that's the stupid shit. But,
and that should be the crime of stupidity, not the crime of doing the actual.
Right.
You know,
I mean, it's just like, look, when it's time-sensitive operational information that's going to take somebody's life, you know, to me, absolutely, I'm with Jeff. I disagree with John McCain. I disagree with General Mattis. When it's time sensitive, immediate information that has the lives of your Marines and sailors and soldiers and airmen or whoever hanging in the balance. To me, you have an obligation to do that, and you take whatever shit you take that goes with it, you know, and you come home and you get back on with your life. No, it's interesting, but again, to me, the frustrating part about the thing in AFRICOM was, I mean, look, anytime we put somebody operationally, and we've all sat in these meetings, right, and you're sitting there and you're going over and off and you're looking at somebody and like, okay, what about them? Oh, yeah, they're going to go and they're tasked with this. Okay, but look, you know, we've got this and we've got this and we've got this medevac capability. We have this drone up. We have this section of air. We're not going to be able to get to them, though. Right. And you've got to solve that. Right. To support them. Now, I know the soft guys, I mean, they have different standards. I mean, they're right. Further out. They have less support. But you got to be able to get to them in some way, shape or form.
You know, my dad hates soft, hates the SF. And I didn't know this till I joined the Navy and told him I was going to try to be a SEAL. He hates him too. And the reason was because in Vietnam, he said all those recon SF, all they were good for was getting infantrymen killed, because he repeatedly was sent into the fray in an unknown situation at night, poorly planned, to try to rescue some of these guys that have gotten pinched. And he said he lost a lot of Marines doing it.
Well,
never thought the juice was worth the squeeze. Never got shit from him.
I would
that he felt.
If you would ask me, you know, my impression of our special ops community, they were still doing that in Al Anbar because, you know, I mean, they did stupid stuff and then you had to kill people to get them out of it. And, you know, I don't want to soft pass because
I have to tell you guys, I'm doing six periods of instruction in the next 3 days up there up there by San Francisco, and I'm doing the Vietnam stuff. And the Vietnam, it's advisor stuff, and there's three types of advising that really came to fruition during Vietnam. One was the Colonel Lethwich, Colonel Ripley, General Smith, General Livingston, Colonel Turley type stuff. That was like basically one guy who's like a one-man show doing it for the Vietnamese battalions. The other thing was the special forces team, these A teams going in there and doing their thing and building, basically making a little firm base around themselves, like Play Me and Lang V and places like that. And the third one is, and this is going to, it's a surprise, but it's like one of the most effective was the combined action platoons of Marine squads with a corpsman doing this. I got to tell you, the historical things I'm doing swirl around the firm-based fights, the fight for Play Me in 1965, which led to the I Drang Valley battle,
right,
and then Lang V, which was a codicil to the Khe Sanh thing.
Right.
And they were so effective that the enemy hated them and committed huge resources to the destruction of these guys because of the effectiveness they were having on this indigenous population, specifically the Montagnards, in the case of Play Me and Lang V. And the first one, the Army tried to help them. The second one, the Marine Corps couldn't help them, you know, because of Khe Sanh, in a situation there which you guys are all well aware of.
Right.
But it's fascinating, you know, the type of stuff those guys went through. And what Timmy's saying there, like about, especially those guys who are 26 Marines, they spent a lot of time chasing after force recon guys, chasing after guys who are,
yep.
And then when this thing happened with Lang V, you know, they're like, we can't get there. We just lost the whole platoon from Bravo 126.
Didn't they try a couple times though to get there?
They did. They tried, but right. Basically what they did is eventually, let me tell you something, and you guys know this already. There's nothing more complex than the artillery blankets that they had around Khe Sanh and the environs of 881, 861, 950. That's how they helped them, and they brought in air. They brought in a QRF to try and help them. But the truth is they got whacked pretty fucking hard.
Right.
They lost a lot of guys.
Well, they would have been gone if that Vietnamese regiment hadn't lost its way and showed up late.
You know what? My brain's telling me now that I didn't probably think of when I read it initially years ago. But based on my experiences in specifically in and around Fallujah in 2006, The reason they whacked the Montagnards, right, was to get the QRF that they knew was coming, and there was one fucking road they were coming down. And that
oh, that is a good supposition.
Right.
Yeah, because, but it didn't work.
Right.
Because they didn't come down there, you know?
Right.
And would you waste the tanks that you had just for that? Because they used tanks to do that. They never used them in Vietnam before. And so there's more. It's an ambiguous thing. I'm with you. I kind of agree. But I'm thinking, why the fuck would they commit those fucking PT-76s to this just to when that would they'd have no role in the QRF at all coming down that road.
Right.
You know. So it's like, but that doesn't mean it's not just a mistake that somebody made. You know, the Vietnamese guys were good commanders. They were fucking hardy dudes, you know. They were in a very rough situation. If we think the guys at Khe Sanh had it rough, the guys who were besieging Khe Sanh had it pretty rough too, you know.
Yeah.
And for sure. So it's like the more I read about this stuff, I'm going to teach this thing the other, you know, in a couple of days. The more I admire the North Vietnamese. You know, for what they went through.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, that in the book that's sitting right here called "The Sorrow of War," written by that guy, that blonde-haired dude in the
Jim Burns documentary. Yeah, I want to read that.
Yeah, his name is Bao Nin, I think is his name. And I mean, he just talks about the black sense of humor because everybody knows they're going to die. It's just a question of when. And you, after you get the shit hammered out, when you get caught in some kind of fucking crazy artillery event, you know, and then you get your ass napalmed, and your 500 man battalion, right, is down to 120 dudes, and you limp back in the vicinity of the Ho Chi Minh Trail to some R&R fucking camp, and they start, you know, telling you how great the harvest is, and now you're reading letters from your family telling you that they're starving to death, and you and it's like you. I never really read about the plight of the NVA soldier, especially up in, you know, up in I Corps, that fucking, you know, that hammer fest with the Marines up there, and you read it, and you're just like Jeff said, you have a completely different perspective for these poor son of a bitches that were just being fed like into the fucking machine, because that's Ho Chi Minh knew that, look, I've got one resource, and that's human beings, and I'm not afraid to waste it in order to get what we need.
If you went to the 8th Marine Regiment in 1988, Ray Smith, we moved from Geiger to Mainside. Ray Smith dug an NVA fighting hole back there. He goes, my fat ass is exhausted. But he goes, this is what every one of these guys dug this exact thing. And it was like perfect. A one-man fighting hole with a grenade sump and a little shelf and everything. He goes, every single fucking one was exactly like this.
For a good reason though, right?
Yeah.
Because your fucking life depends on it.
Right.
Your life depends on that fucking shovel you got in your hand there, bud.
Yep. And you could take a bunch of guys who could all do that. There's no end to the good things militarily you could do with them.
Right.
You know, you get Bill Lind, he'd say, oh, this is stupid. It doesn't fit the maneuver warfare aspects of using a tree root to help protect you and shit, you know. But the motherfucking fact is, you get fucking 500 guys, every one of them does that. There's no limit what you can do with those guys.
It's real interesting because when you hear them talk, why was their field craft so good? Why were they so disciplined? Because
they're not woodsmen. They're from the city.
Right? They're poor kids from the ghetto. They
gave me this book when I first got to TBS for EI Company called PAVN Cohesion. In the North Vietnamese Army. Remember that book that was going around?
I didn't see it. Fucker didn't give it to me. I just talked to him last night.
shit.
Where do I fucking talk to his dumb ass again?
Cohesion and something else was in it. Cohesion and... But that's what it was about, that type of shit, you know?
But one of the things that he says, and it made me think about the Battle of Gettlin's Corner, and what he says is, if you were not disciplined, right, if you, in the face of the Americans... they would literally liquidate you. That's what they would do. So your field craft had to be good. And when you tied into them, you had to get close and you had to stay close to negate their ability to do combined arms. And then when you disengage, you had to haul fucking ass. And then you had to change directions about three different times within a very short, you know, distance. So you could get not only vertical space, but horizontal space too. And then change it from the last known position that they probably saw you, you know, at and shot at you with. And you had to go from there and offset that. It's almost like, you know, what Ernest Evans did, right? In, you know, they would chase the, they would chase the splashes of, of the incoming.
Thinking that they were a battleship and a top of line cruiser, top of line carrier instead of a Jeep carrier and a fucking destroyer.
Well,
but
when Ernest Evans and the USS Johnson is closing with the Japanese, what, and I, this was a crazy technique, but they would chase the last known impacts in the water of the guns.
You can't hit the safest place to be.
You're not gonna, he's not going to shoot the same place again. So they're closing on the Japanese. And I'll tell you what, I sent Tim and Jeff a couple of links, and the, when you combine the two of them, you got a real good sense for this time and space. And Jesus Christ, man.
You know what would make that a great movie is the fact that the Japanese were using huge, those naval gunfire shells were all dye covered so that there'd be a big red explosion in the water and a big yellow explosion. Remember that? So that they knew who was shooting what. Who was shooting what?
And but Evans, you know, he turns around like two different fucking times. And they've got sailors on the ship saying, "We've done enough." And he's not having it. But I mean, he's the tail end. You know, he's at 6 o'clock of the movement when he orders, left flank, and then they turn and they close on the Japanese, man, and you see that stuff. The other thing I didn't realize, you know, I thought they gave independent data to the separate guns. I didn't realize that the gun director was capable, and you see the computers, the gun computing system they had at the time. It's incredible to watch it, right? And the amount, the number of shells that got shot in a 5 minute period. They shot like 284
rounds. Yeah, that was amazing to me.
Holy shit!
That was something. Yeah. They should. That guy Sam Mendes, who made that movie, which also you should see if you haven't already, 1917.
Right.
Sam Mendes should make that movie, The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors.
The story's unbelievable, but, I'll put the two links into this post, because they're really interesting. One is done by I think a military researcher who's looked at all the after action reports. And the cool part about that is when he's talking about a certain class ship, he puts a picture of either that ship or a ship like it, and he starts describing the gun director, or the guy was blown out of the aft hatch of the number two gun, 5-inch gun forward, and all of a sudden you see a picture of it, and you're like, oh, okay, I got it now. And so, and then he has maps in there. So I found that really, I liked the technical part of that, but I didn't have any concept of,
because we had no idea what the fuck really went into it.
And again, I had no idea how they aim naval guns. I mean, they don't do that anymore.
Exactly right. I just thought they looked through the barrel. Okay, looks good. Put in the shell.
Where's that fucking spyglass? It was here a second ago. God damn it.
I want you two to know that I am now following what you're tracking with what you're talking about, because I downloaded that book too and started reading it like 2 days ago, and it's a time thief. You can't put it down. It's damn interesting story.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. And again, what to me, there's two decision, and I mean, my lens is right as somebody's taught decision making, but first of all, Evans, you know, he just turns to Johnson and says, "Let's go, boys." And I mean, and the accuracy of the gunfire from the Johnson, you know, ripping into, I want to say it's a heavy cruiser right at the start, and then they launch torpedoes and they blow the bow off another cruiser.
They blow the bow off. That's a game changer.
Right off.
That got into Kurita's mind.
Oh, my God.
That happened. He's like, he thought there was more facing him than there really was because of that incident.
Yeah, so Johnston and Evans, I mean, he throws two, like, right hooks, like, right off the bat, and holy shit. And then the other one is made by Sprague, who, unlike at Midway, when they're trying to change ordnance on the airplanes, he says, launch everything immediately. I don't care what you fucking have. I don't care if you have nothing. And some aircraft launch with no ordnance.
Nothing.
Yeah. And they went out there and they did their fucking job. They spotted.
Like the guys with the fucking the frags for killing troops on the ground.
Right.
And they're like, fuck it. We're going anyway.
And they did. And they did. And they did all kinds of damage. But it's this competitive OODA loop event, right, where you see guys and it reminds me of, you know, a little bit of some of the shit you read about Nathan Bedford Forrest, right?
Yes.
Smaller force but an immediate decision and violently executed. You don't hear of another general that fought in the Civil War that killed anybody. Right, Forrest kills with his own hands.
33 guys.
Yeah, 18. I think it's 18.
General Allen told me 33. He might have been.
Well, he's from the South, so he probably did. But the other
14 guys are his own guys.
Exactly. And so, but you see that in the Battle of Samar, right? Yeah. And you see this incredible courage, and it's amazing. I don't know how we got there from Vietnam, but we did.
If anyone's following along, they learned a lot.
Exactly. The book.
I wasn't, but I.
But I did. The book is called Sorrow of War by Bao Ninh, and he goes back, and at some points it seems like fiction almost, but he goes back down to. Well, there's no DMZ anymore after the war, but he goes back and to reclaim bodies that have been left down there, and kind of story. He kind of goes in and out of his combat experiences, but I mean, it's just gruesome, you know, the fatal sense of humor, these political commissar motherfuckers that come down and just are bullshit liars to them, and they're reading, and like I said, they're reading their mail from home, and they're like, fuck, our families aren't eating enough. This is, we're all going to die. Like, what the fuck are we doing down here?
One more thing. We're getting rid of the Mod Deuce for good. Can you believe that?
No, I can't.
No.
Wait a minute. I just saw that we're buying polymer ammunition for it. What do you mean we're getting rid of it?
I just read an article in the newspaper. It was on the Facebook. Not Facebook.
There you go.
Can't remember.
Fake news.
Purpose.
Fake news.
They're getting rid of the Mod Deuce because I know that we stopped teaching the Afghans the Mod Deuce because they got a new 50 cal the Army was starting to field that you'd have to do timing and headspace and all that bullshit.
Oh, right.
Which makes the whole difference with the Mod Deuce, you know. The Mod doing timing and headspace in the Mod Deuce is like remembering how to do the aim and circle to lay in a gun line.
And it says Marine Special Ops ditching the Mod Deuce after 80 years.
Yeah.
So just Special Ops are. Weapons company's still going to have that motherfucker.
That's what I mean. I think there's a modern model, not a Mod Deuce, but of a 50 cal, where you don't have to do timing and headspace. I can't imagine that. But that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, no, but because the accompanying story that I saw about the 50 cal this week is, you know, that we're buying lighter polymer ammunition.
Right, right.
So, but the soft guy's saying, yeah, we don't want it anymore. Okay, well, you know, find something that works good. Yeah, we'll take.
Let me tell you something. That fucking that thing dominates, man.
And there's nothing that sounds like it either. Boom, 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 boom.
Yeah, I mean, bop, bop, bop. I mean, it goes off next to you. You don't hear it, and you don't hear anything else for about 10 minutes.
My daughter, you know, when I lived the last place I lived in San Clemente before, you know, after I got off active duty, it was above the golf course, right above the public golf course, just a stone's throw from Cristianitos.
So you're hearing all that shit from
at night, right?
Yeah, okay.
Right. So at night, right, you're hearing like the machine gun ranges and shit like that.
Yeah.
And one night my daughter looks at me, she goes, "Does that bother you?" And she goes, I said, "Oh my God, it makes me sleep like a baby."
No shit.
Right? I said, "I love that sound." And my daughter looks at me, she goes, you're not right. I said, no. I said, you know, I've grown up around those noises. I mean, I could tell you every gun that barks. I could tell you which one it is and is it remotely pointing towards us?
Yeah, right.
And and she's like, really? And I said, yep. I said, Colleen, that's the sound of freedom.
That's right. That is.
The Ma Deus,
that's the
baby.
Sound of... Vietnamese people's arms and legs flying off
the bandit. Wow. And don't say, well, I mean, Vietnamese, Japanese, Koreans.
That's what it did to them. I'm just
right? Did we have it in Bella Wood? No.
No. No.
No.
1919.
Yeah.
It was like that's the right. BAR. It was designed for World War I, but never was used during World War I.
Yeah. I mean, if you can imagine a weapon system like the B-52, right, that has been so good for so long that it just keeps being modified and being used, which is absolutely amazing.
Deuce, BAR, and the Thompson submachine gun, great weapons designed for World War I, never saw action in World War I.
All right, final kind of trivia question, and we'll put this marathon thing to a bed. With this rambling Rain Man-esque going from tsunamis to the courage of NBA soldiers to back to the Battle of Lady Gulf and Taffy 3. That's an incredible story. But anyway, favorite weapon in your Marine Corps career?
Weapon in my Marine Corps career.
Yeah, and only you can only pick one. The weapon you like the most.
M60.
M60 machine gun.
Yep.
Why?
Because I remember that. That's the first.
Wait. Which version of it?
The first one, the A1. Not the one, not the Echo 3 with the carrying handle. Although that was a good weapon too, but I'm talking a good old pig. That's what we called it when I first came in, the pig.
Right.
Because it ate ammo, man, like nobody's business. Had a big square fucking, like, you know, handguard underneath the barrel. The whole thing about it was changing the barrel.
You had the big mitt, right?
Yeah, the big mitt and the fucking, and the whole idea of working at T&E, you know, this is a fucking great weapon.
Right. Timmy, your favorite weapon?
Squad automatic weapon. I always like that. And
Timmy, why don't you put your mouth closer to the microphone? That way we can actually not understand a fucking thing you say.
I'm doing it again. I'm getting. Hold on. There we go.
God.
Is it better now?
You think?
Yeah, sorry, dude. I keep on leaning in and that. Now I've got the microphone, so when I lean in, it's far away. But I like the squad automatic weapon. I thought that was a great piece of gear.
It is a great piece of gear.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought, and this is because I did time as a LAR guy, but the original 25mm had this kind of spreadsheet grid. It was the easiest weapon I've ever shot in my life.
Yeah, you're right. It is a good. I don't have any experience that you have.
I haven't been in an LAV, you know, turret since 1993. So this is old core shit, but we had, it was just like, you know, a piece of glass and it had a spreadsheet on it, right? A clear spreadsheet, the grid, and you went, so you'd find the target, all of a sudden, you know, you'd slew to it, target, right? And the gunner would boom, boom, boom. You know, rounds come close, and all she would do is take wherever the impact was, put that on the target, and boom, second round hits 100% of the time.
That's like the fucking M79, man. It's real simple. It's almost it's almost intuitive how you use it. You know, it was when I came in, they're getting rid of it, and they're doing the M70 or the 203.
Okay, so just for everybody, the scene in Apocalypse Now. Where the black dude comes out of the bunker by the river at night,
yeah, right.
And the guy says, "Do you hear him?" He's like, "Yeah, man, I hear him.
He's close, man. He's real close."
And then he shoots the M79, and then they wait, and you hear, poof,
yeah,
in the background, and you hear the guy yell, "Ah!"
Yeah, right.
And then he asks, you know, oh, then Martin Sheen says something like, "Where's your commanding officer?" And the dude says.
Ain't you him?
Ain't you? Look, that's the M. That's the M79. Just so everyone knows.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right, boys. First of all, extended version. I appreciate your time tonight, and we'll talk to you next week.
Rock. Thanks, Matt.
Hey,
thanks,
sounds good, Matt.
More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.